You already have a meeting?
Sure.
My name's Lindsay. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Lindsay.
Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speaker meeting here at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language, from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them. I must have this thing. Now I'm going to introduce our speaker tonight. His name is Daryl. He's a member of the Fifth Tradition group, and I'm very excited to hear what he has to share with us. So please welcome Daryl.
Hi, I'm Daryl. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
I'm here tonight, really. Somebody asked me to speak on the 5th, and I thought, well, that's 5 days after Labor Day, and so that's there's no problem with that. And evidently, I've gone 68 years not really understanding when Labor Day is. Labor Day is the first Monday. Now I know, before I die off, that Labor Day is the first Monday in September. So if you're like me and you're just unaware of your surroundings, that's when it is. And the reason I tell you that is because you don't have to be smart or know what's going on a lot to get sober. I've been sober for 15 years, 6-11-07. And well, there's people in this room that's been a lot. But what I'm saying is I was absolutely unable to get sober before then. I picked up my first white chip in 1979, I think. Yeah, 1979. And I didn't like AA. You know what I remember about it is it sort of looked black and white. Everything else was in color until I got in the AA rooms. It just seemed like it was black and white. I didn't like it. But anyway, let me start off. I was born in McMinnville, Tennessee. Anybody ever been to McMinnville? It's a nice place right up next to the plateau. But anyway, that's where I was born. My mom and dad worked in a movie theater, and my dad really was up for starting a movie theater, and he wanted to borrow the money from my uncle to get one. And so he worked it out with my uncle, and of course I'm a baby, I just heard about this. But anyway, we moved to Columbia, Tennessee, when I was 3 months old or something like that. And he put down some money on a drive-in in Columbia, Tennessee, and that's where I was born and raised. Well, not where I was born, but that's where I was raised, in Columbia, Tennessee. And I'm going to tell you, the world was completely different then. The drive-in, it was walking distance, and it fit me perfect because I was one of these kids, I couldn't sleep. For one thing, I was drinking Cokes and stuff all the time at the drive-in, and I was loaded with caffeine, which added to the anxiety which I already had going on. And so I didn't sleep. I like roaming around all night. I like sneaking out of the house and roaming around. It fit me perfect. And especially, you know, tearing stuff up. I like to get out, and I think that get out, tear some stuff up, and don't go to bed. But anyway, seems like alcoholism has been some kind of dang issue in my family as far back as I can remember. When I was a little kid, my uncle and my cousin were both real chronic alcoholics. It wasn't so much with my uncle because he was a doctor. And I say that because he was enabled by the entire town. I mean, at, most of the people in the town, he birthed them. He was in the hospital and gave he gave birth to them. Doesn't give birth to them. What do you call it?
Delivered
them. That's the word I was looking for. Thank you so much. but anyway, but he was getting bad. But I had this cousin who lived in Dover, Tennessee, and I remember when I was a little kid, everybody was talking, and he had been locked up. We didn't have nice little treatment centers to go to back in the late 50s and early 60s. We had Central State. We had insane asylums. They didn't have treatment centers. Well, they may have had them, but evidently they didn't notice in him there. And he ended up in these insane asylums. And what they would do if you were an alcoholic and after you quit drinking, if you're too depressed, they'd give you shock treatments or whatever. And so they'd get him off alcohol and they'd give him these shock treatments and he'd be happy for a while. Until he started drinking again. It didn't seem to be a very good system, but I mean, it's the only system they had. And I remember everybody talking, and there wasn't a lot of anonymity either. It seems like if he told a doctor something, everybody in the family knew about it. But anyway, the family was sort of shocked, and I was listening to it. He had told a doctor he'd rather have a tall boy than anything else on earth. And then he'd already been in this place for like 30 days. And then, just think about that. If you got a family member locked up in an insane asylum, and all he can really come up with that he wants more than anything else on earth is a tall boy. And it was really shocking. And I looked at alcoholism as just, I don't want anything to do with that. But although I did have this enormous anxiety that alcohol would soon fix later on, but that it was an issue in my family, and my dad looked at me. He looked at me like he's gonna have trouble. He would say things that really pissed me off when I was a kid. You're like, just like Joe Bailey. Joe Bailey was a cousin that was in insane asylum. And he didn't know what to do. He saw this kid who was nervous. I just needed a drink. Evidently I looked like a kid who needed a drink. And I couldn't sleep. I was sneaking out. I was nervous and da 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 da. And just I just looked like somebody who needed a drink. I mean, he was, the older I got, the more desperate he got to try to do something. And he promised me a car. I'll get you a car when you turn 16 if you'll just not drink alcohol. And I'm good with that. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I saw what it was doing to my uncle. I saw what it was doing to my cousin. He was in and out of this insane asylum in Nashville. And I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to have anything to do with it until I drank. And that happened when I was 15 years old. Me and it's funny, I was sort of already running around with a group of people who were definitely going to drink. But we all had a couple of quarts of beer. And when I was 15 years old, I drank two quarts of beer and fell in love. I can sort of remember that night still. And I'm 68 years old, how great that night was. I mean, I slept that night. I wasn't nervous that night. I didn't feel the need to run over there. Or if I was over there, I didn't feel the need to get back over here. I was okay. I was okay right where I was in my own skin. And it was the most, it was heaven. And I decided whatever's the problem these people are having with alcoholism, I don't have it. Because it's my damn answer. And it was, and it, I had this love affair and a grace period. We'll call it a grace period. It seemed that I say a year, it could have been 9 months, whatever. But I had this period where alcohol just worked perfect, and then it started going downhill. And it started, I'm 16 years old, and I'm starting to have troubles with alcoholism. My dad caught me drinking. Of course, that was after I got the car. I did get the car, but and I think you know, me and him had a lot of problems because he saw where this deal was going, and he had his own problems with alcohol. But he had this enormous will; he would just stop, and he would sort of get in a drunk, but he had this willpower or whatever. He would just not touch it, you know, for a while, and but when he did, he got, you know. But anyway, I did the best I could, and but I'd already fell in love with alcohol, and it was my go-to thing. You know what I mean? It was just there's drugs in my story, but alcohol was the deal. Alcohol was always there. Drugs were a sideshow. When LSD came around, and that was, you know, 16 or 17, I mean, it was early 1971, LSD came around. Alcohol just helped me do LSD and not have any problems with it. You know, and I would tell people, well, you know, you won't be freaking out if you'll just drink. Calm down. Shut up. And it was a cure-all for everything. And then slowly but surely, you know, the alcoholism is progressive. I could never get a handle. I wanted more than anything else to be able to drink. I really did. You know, I used to think, you know, people wonder whether, they talk about whether they're a Bill Wilson type of alcoholic or a Dr. Bob type of alcoholic. And I always thought I was a Bill Wilson type of alcoholic just because of the things I'd read about him. But I found out that wasn't true at all. I read this thing about Ebby Thatcher. It turns out I'm an Ebby Thatcher type of alcoholic. Because he was just a boho. He just could not stay sober. And people turn their backs and Ebby's drunk. And that was me. You know, and I'd read that also, that Bill Wilson's wife, what's her name? Lois. Thank you. I'm glad y'all are here. Lois Wilson had said that Bill Wilson wanted to stay sober with every fiber of his being, and Ebby Thatcher wanted to stay sober enough to stay out of trouble. That's what I wanted. That's when I started coming to AA. I wanted to just trouble. There was always some type of trouble, and I would park my car in Columbia, Tennessee. They had an AA house. And I would park my car out front with the police, and everybody could see that's where I am, leaving alone. And I would stay in there. But you know this thing, and I didn't. I was buying into the fact. Okay, I'm a chronic relapser. If somebody tells you you're a chronic relapser, that's not true. I mean, you may be chronically relapsing. But that's not the case. We're just doing what we're doing. We're alcoholics. We're not treated. And if we're not treated, we're going to treat ourselves. And the way I treated myself is the thing that I found when I was 15 years old, and that is alcohol. I tried to lead a normal life. I went to a two-year college in Columbia, Tennessee, and did pretty good, got out of there. It was a community college and started UT Knoxville and met a wonderful girl there. She was the last victim woman that I'd met. She was just an innocent bystander of my life. And she was in first year law. She was a great, we loved each other. Now I say that as much as an alcoholic can love somebody. And that's one thing I believe when those treatment centers say, you know, you loved alcohol more. Yeah, I did. I loved alcohol more than I loved her. I have to admit that today. But I loved her as much as an alcoholic can love another person, which maybe is not that much. But anyway, I ended up punching her out in a blackout. because I've gotten to the point where I was blacking out and waking up and not knowing what was going on, not knowing what was happening, having to call people, and it's a nightmare of a life. And when I think about it today, I wonder, why God didn't I try to do something? But, you know, that denial, man, it's so good. Tomorrow I'm going to do something. And tomorrow just don't get here. Today just keeps on rolling. But anyway, I decided after that happened, I'm going to do something. So I started going to AA meetings in Knoxville, Tennessee when I was a kid. Well, not a kid, but I was 20-something. I don't remember. And I hated those meetings. And I, you know, I said, okay, I quit for 6 months. And I was happy about quitting for 6 months. And I wanted to drink, I think, every second of the day before I took a drink, finally. And I finally did take a drink. And that's when she looked at me different. You know what I mean? I could tell the way she was looking at me, we were through. Because she's, you know, she didn't need to be dragging an alcoholic along in her career, in her legal career. But anyway, we split up. And so after we split up, I was really in shock. And so I decided to go get some help. And I called some people and I'd moved back home. And I decided to go to this place in Nashville. It's called Parthenon Pavilion. And that was the... I was happy to be in that treatment center. They give you drugs the minute you get there. They gave me some Librium to calm down, and I didn't know what Librium was. That's a big word for me. But as far as I was concerned, these people had discovered a cure for alcoholism, and that cure was Librium. And they start you out on high doses of Librium while you're there, and, man, I was calmed down, and I wasn't drinking. And I thought, these people are awesome. And it was just, and they gave me stuff at night to help me sleep. I mean, it's just absolutely, I thought I finally found a cure. And so when I left the Parthenon Pavilion, I think I was there like 15 days, and I was now cured. I went straight to my uncle, who was a doctor, alcoholic, and he got me a prescription. It was a good value. I could get like 100 of these 25-milligram Librium for like $8, which is good value. So I no longer drank. I just eat Librium. I'd eat Librium in the morning when I got up, during the day when the things got a little too heavy, and double dose at night before I go to bed. So I didn't need to drink anymore. I was cured. And, of course, alcoholism and it's just whatever you're doing today, you need more tomorrow. And that's the way it was. I mean, it turned out to be a really rotten trick. My uncle kept telling me, do not drink, taking out this Librium. And one night I just, hey, give me a gin and tonic. And I started drinking on top of these Librium. And I ended up in really, really bad shape in a treatment center in Nashville, Cumberland Heights. And this was bad enough. I was hallucinating. I hallucinated the whole time. And I was, I'm going to do something. But the trouble was, and I didn't tell you all this. I need to tell you, but there's I had split with God a long time ago. I had split with God when I was a kid. We had a drive-in, of course, and it was me and my mother and my brother were sitting in the church, and this preacher, Robert E. Lee, that was his name, seriously. I'm telling you, I'm not making this up. His name is Robert E. Lee, and he gave a sermon while we're sitting in there. Why people shouldn't go to the drive-in because there was a sin pit and all this carnal stuff's going on, and I'm sitting there punching my mother, saying, we need to get the hell out of here. We need to go. And I turned around and looked at her, and she's crying. And I thought, I'll get him one day. I will get this guy. And so me and God and the church split right then. And as soon as I was old enough, I never went back. And the only reason Dad wanted us to go was because they would end up going to the drive-in and protesting certain movies that they thought that, you know, everybody's going to. But anyway, I didn't like them. I can tell you that. Yeah. As a matter of fact, when I did get a car, the one thing I really enjoyed is on Saturday night, driving up to the church, emptying all the beer cans out in the front of that church. that was my to-do thing before I went home. And they were all in the car. I threw them in the back, and then I drove in front of the church, and here you go, boys. And but anyway, let's get back up to the treatment center. I was in Cumberland Heights, and I saw the steps on the wall, and I didn't see the steps on the wall at the Parthenon Pavilion. They had the steps on the wall, and there's God, and I thought, I don't want anything to do with this, and I immediately went to talk to my counselor. I said, listen, I don't do God. I've done God when I was a kid, and he said, well, just act as if. He sort of blew me off. I said, well, just act as if. And I said, okay. Which, you know, went in one ear and out the other. But anyway, I rolled through Cumberland Heights and got out and decided I wasn't going to drink anymore. And but this time I had to exist on no pills and no alcohol. I was really scared this time. But it's funny how we can think the most. I mean, when that step where it says, you know, we're insane, restore us to sanity. I mean, it's absolutely real. You know, you can be dying from something, and then I started having the thought, well, you know, if I hadn't done those two together, it would have been all right. So this was in my mind: if just don't take the pills and drink at the same time. And not only that, I would get some pills, and I thought, instead of having to go to a treatment center, I'll detox myself. And so I kept detox medications I got from my uncle in the closet. And so I began to drink. Of course, when I'm drinking, I'm thinking, well, you know, the detox medications are in the closet. I could have a couple. And so that was my life, just desperately trying to live life and drink, or take something to ease this horrible anxiety, and nothing was working. And so, of course, I went back, and as a matter of fact, I went back two more times to Cumberland Heights, and the third time I was there, they told me, we can't let you back here anymore, and so, because really, at Cumberland Heights, it was a 28-day treatment center. It makes them look bad if you got somebody who's just up there all the time, and it's just bad on the other patients. They got more respect for the one-timers there. They don't have a lot of respect for it if you come, you know, rolling in every other year. But anyway, I didn't go back there anymore. I started going to hospital. And finally something happened, and I quit for 3 or 4 years out of just sitting on my hands because I discovered these muscle relaxers, and I decided to detox myself with muscle relaxers. And then, of course, I went out and drove and almost hit a school bus during the middle of the day. And there were some pissed off people at me in a really bad way. It's cops, you know, we were sort of we had a drive-in. Everybody knew who we were. And I had friends, you know, some of my friends were starting to, you know, get away from me, because you don't want to be friends with somebody and kill somebody on the road, you know, especially intoxicated. But anyway, they were starting to drop off, and the people that cared about me were starting to drop off. And but anyway, I quit for a good amount of time, and I started going to AA. And I swear to God, it seemed like in our AA group, there was people that were there every day. I'd show up at noon, we'd go out and eat, but they weren't doing anything. They weren't working any steps, and that's what I decided to do. Well, I didn't even understand that to begin with. That was fine with me, because I don't want to get in this God stuff. I'll just go to AA, hang with these guys, and go to meetings, and I'll be okay. But say I'm an alcoholic. I can sit in a meeting 24 hours a day, and it's not going to stop me from drinking. It didn't stop me at all. And it was all in the book. You know, when I look back on this book, it explained me. I'm going to read something. It's something, it's shocking because it's been there. I thought, I had read this book so many times. It's amazing what you can't see if you don't want to. Wait a minute. I wanted to read you that because it scared me from the book. But anyway, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. That was me. You know, this is repeated over and over, and it can repeat for 30 years if you let it. With a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless that person can experience an entire psychic change, there is little hope of his recovery. And I didn't understand that. Sitting in meetings wasn't doing me any good because I wasn't having, you know, I pushed this kind thing away and it just wasn't happening for me. And but anyway, I told you I managed to stay sober for a while. Then I picked up on another drug. I'm in a convenience store, and this girl in front of me pulls money out of this halter top, and I fall in love. Man, I like her. What a girl. And it turns out she happened to sell this stuff. And I found that out the second time I went over there. And so I finally found something to really bring me down. And what it was rocks. Well, anyway. It was cocaine that they made into rocks. But anyway, I don't want to talk about drugs. But like I said, if whatever drug you would have had. I'm very grateful today that there wasn't a fentanyl around. I wouldn't be standing here. But anyway, I went through that a couple of years. But that's what brought me to Atlanta, because I'd gotten such bad shape. I followed that all the way into Nashville. I was living on the street, living under bridges, living in a drug dealer's house. I mean, it was absolute total insanity. And so there was a couple of people who still cared about me, amazingly enough, because you couldn't trust me at all. Because, you know, all the lines I said I wouldn't cross, I'm starting to cross them. All the things I said I wouldn't do, I'm starting to do. And my life's going down the tubes. And so I end up in Atlanta in a long-range treatment center I stayed in this treatment center and craved alcohol and drugs for 13 months. And I figured I'm doomed. And my dad used to say that. He said I was doomed. And I spotted it in the book. These people seemed doomed, and that word, it was just horrible. But I was starting to see that, you know, my life, I'm doomed. But anyway, so I got out of there, and I started up the whole thing again, and I tried to control it, and I spent so much miserable time, you know, trying to control the alcohol, trying to control the drugs, trying to stay out of trouble, trying not to get on other people's nerves, lost a job, just a stinking mess. And then I went back into, finally went back into Mar. And so they took me back again, and I'm still a mess, and I'm craving it the whole time. I'm craving alcohol, I'm craving drugs, and after I got out of there, I put together, I think, and I'm working with this guy, and I'm trying to do what you guys are doing, except for the God part. And you know, if you don't like the God part, that's a pretty big part in here. but anyway, I'm trying to do that, and I'm trying to pray, and I'm trying to get that resentment away, and you know, I'm just so full of crap. Because, you know, I think, well, I don't believe in God, so this thing ain't going to work. God doesn't care what we believe. He just cares what we do. So anyway, I'm working with this guy, and you know, one day, and 6 months after I got out of Mar for the second time, and my ex-wife's moved up here with me, and she's managed to, she went through enough with the crack to where, she went through enough to where she wasn't going to touch it anymore because, I mean, we went down. It was bad. But, one day I went and got some alcohol and I got some more of this stuff and I'm doing it. And it just seemed like it wasn't, it wasn't doing to me what it used to do, and I don't think I've ever been in that big of despair before. I finally saw that, you know, I'm better off dead. I'm not going to make it. I'm going to die from this. I'm not going to get sober. I never have gotten sober. I came in here when I was in 1979, and then I'm 53 years old now, and I'm not going to make it. It's going to kill me, And so suicide looked like a really good idea, and that's what I wanted to do. And thank goodness I'm such a coward and a chicken shit, but that I didn't do that. And that's why I'm standing here, because I was a coward. I just wouldn't kill myself. But when it gets to the point it looks like, you know, the best thing you can do for everybody around you is kill yourself, do something. Because that's what it looked like to me. Then it was the truth. I was nothing but a pain in the ass to everybody around me. I was a danger to society. There just wasn't any hope. Because as soon as I'll jump up and run and get some more. It doesn't seem to matter what happened. It doesn't matter how many treatment centers I go to. It doesn't matter if I stay in a treatment center 13 months. I'll still do it. I'll give you the finger and go do what I want, but I didn't have the nerve to kill myself. But you know, something wonderful happened during that weekend, that deal. I got a cat. I had two cats. They both died of old age now. But anyway, my cat got really sick. Because I was keeping everything on this coffee table, and I was keeping beer underneath the coffee table and the drugs on top of the coffee table, and it was a stinking mess. And the cat got really sick, and so I took this cat to the vet, and they're going, listen, this vitals are terrible. What's happened? And I didn't tell them I thought I'd eat some drugs. That's probably what happened, and the cat wasn't going to make it. And so I go home, and that's the first time I've ever, like, done an actual prayer to where I connected. And I didn't ask to be sober. I didn't ask for God to just strike me dead. All I asked for is to God to pull this cat through. And the cat pulled through. Now, I'm not going to tell y'all, you know, that God came down and touched my cat. I'm not telling you that. I'm saying all this happened as far as I was concerned. as far as I'm concerned, God did save that cat because of some other things that happened. For the first time in my life, absolutely the first time in my life, because of the things I was doing, because of the prayers I was saying, I started talking to God during the day. It's weird. You know, I'd get mad, and, you know, I was trying to go to work, and if I got on the road, it's like God saved me from being angry. I started doing this stuff that I'd been hearing about for years, and all of a sudden, I didn't want to use drugs or alcohol. I didn't want to drink. And that was absolutely a new, unique feeling to me because I wanted to drink before I ever drank. I wanted something. You know, one of the happiest points of my childhood, there used to be this thing called paregoric. Anybody remember that? Yeah, my parents gave me some paregoric, and I was so happy. I was about dead, 102 degrees fever, and next I'm out the door running down the street. So there was always, I needed something out there, but I didn't want anything out there. And I kept thinking, you know, with this situation, I think I could do this AA thing. I think AA would be a lot easier if I'm not drinking. And it turns out AA is a lot easier if you're not drinking and you're not doing drugs. And so I went to this. As far as I was concerned, 1, 2, and 3 had been done right then because I'd absolutely refused to do them before. And so I go to this sponsor. I say, listen, I know I've been jerking you around. I know you don't really believe anything I say because, you know, you couldn't believe anything I said. And I said, but if you want to, we'll start and I'll do exactly what you tell me. I'll do what you tell me to do. You know, and if it works, it works. And he said, well, let me call you and I will let you know. And so he called me the next day, okay, let's do this. And so we started working the steps. And I did exactly what he told me to do. And I remembered there's this guy I used to listen to from Louisville, Kentucky. His name, I can't remember. What's his name? But anyway, he said, it doesn't matter what you think, feel, or believe. What matters is what you do. And so my actions, I prayed like, you know, I was praying and I was trying to be as honest as possible. But honest as possible for me wasn't that stinking honest because I'd never really been honest in my life. And so anyway, I'd done a 4-step and we met in this park. And we decided, I told him a lot about my life. I told him a lot that I'd done. And I did a fairly good 4-step, except what I was lying about. And he did something great for me. He said, did you leave anything out? And I said, no. And then he said it again, though. He said, listen, did you leave anything out? I said, yeah, I did. And so we sat there another few hours, and I told him stuff I'd never told anybody before. And it was a big deal to me, because I think I'm a big deal. And it turns out, you know, I'll probably tell y'all tonight, it's not a big, because I'm not a big deal to me today. But it was a big deal then. And I can tell you, when I left that park after doing that, you know, with this psychic change and the spiritual experience that I was having and doing this, I mean, I'd never felt that good before. You know, it felt better than a tall boy. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it was awesome. And I started living, life and I knew from being AA, being in AA and being a total asshole, this has been back in the 90s. I mean, when I was in there, and, you know, I just could not. If there was a woman who was a psychopath and probably kill you, I just fell in love. We ended up together. We got to go out. And, And I was attracted to every psycho, and of course I'm a psycho, and so they, we got along fine. We didn't. And so I knew that I'm gonna have to leave the women alone. I can't live like that anymore. And luckily enough, I was getting older. There was things between me and God, not in the book or anything, but I can't do anymore. I've got to live life. I got to be a gentleman in AA. I've got to be decent because, I think I've been given this wonderful opportunity to get sober. If God's going to take away the desire to drink, I don't think He'll do it if I'm being an asshole. I don't think He'll do it if I'm, I don't think He'll keep this wonderful gift I've been given if I'm hurting people. And so that's a big thing for me today. I just don't want to hurt anybody. Because I've hurt a lot of people. You guys have shown me how to do that. I can live in this society. I don't have to struggle anymore. When I was 30 days sober, Doug Brush at Mars said, I told him, I said, I'm not finding a job, Doug, because I wanted a job in an office. My brain's burnt up and from drugs and alcohol, and I think I want a job in an office. I couldn't even find the office, But anyway, I kept going to this Kroger close to me, and I was friends with the store manager. She said, "Well, why don't you work here? We need people." And I said, "Oh my God, Kroger!" And I did, and so I went. I started at Kroger when I was 30 days sober, and I went from thinking I was a hot shot in a town where me and my brother owned a movie theater to I'm pushing these carts in. In a crook. And let me tell you, that saved my ass. That saved my ass. Because there's no way to get out there and think you're a hot shot when you're pushing them carts in. And they got a and it is the most wonderful gift that I've ever been given. I'm 68 years old. I want to retire, but I've got this love for Kroger because it's been there. I've been sober without drugs or alcohol the whole time I've been working there. And it's just part of it. I've learned so much from, I don't know if you want to call it friends, but I know so many great people, and normal, well-adjusted people that are friends of mine. It's amazing. I used to sit and I back home in Tennessee. I'd be in some kind of trouble. I get drunk, get in some kind of trouble. I always think, why can't I be like Joe down the street? He's just raising a family. He's okay. What's the matter with me? Because I didn't want to be. I didn't want to be like Joe. All I wanted was a quick fix. That's the only thing I wanted to. In the back of my mind, I wanted to live a good life, but the only thing that interested me was something that made me feel good, and that was my basic chemistry. How I felt was the center of the universe, and you don't matter. That was the ugly truth of it. What I can do to make me feel good, to make my life better, that was absolutely correct. And when I saw it in the big book, it doesn't have anything to do with drinking. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem. I thought, my God, that's so true. This book is absolutely correct. I'm not unique. I'm not different than you guys because I've batted around 30 years in this program. I'm an alcoholic. That's it. That's the explanation of why I would not get so. I just would not do it. So if you're having trouble with alcohol, it's very easy. You don't have to poison your cat. All you got to do is you find a sponsor and start doing it. Doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter whether you believe it. It just, if you start doing this, it starts working. And I know because, you know, it saved my ass. Thank y'all so much.
Thank you, Daryl. That was great.
Live forever in our hearts.